Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. These days, I feel like I can't make sense of the news until I've talked it out with my friends. So I made a new show where we do that every week. It's called It's Been a Minute. That's my way of saying let's catch up. Find It's Been a Minute now on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast. Thanks.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. You know the singer Beth Ditto, right? She used to front the band The Gossip, also called Gossip. She's got a new solo album out. She lives in Portland right now. She grew up in Searcy, Arkansas, pretty small town, just about an hour outside Little Rock. There was no MTV, just a handful of punk rock shows. After high school, she did the thing a lot of punk kids do. She packed everything up and moved to a cooler, bigger city. For Beth, that city was Olympia, Washington, a place that couldn't be more different than Searcy.
You know, listen, you take that bus downtown, you go to the Capitol Theater, you go to Homo Agogo. There's kissing booths. I mean, there were like queer kissing booths where you could pay a dollar to kiss another girl. That was my first kiss. That's the first time I kissed a girl. I paid a dollar. So cheap.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk with Beth about her new solo record, her time spent fronting the band The Gossip, and how when you're a kid setting up punk shows in a little town in Arkansas, there really isn't such a thing as cliques.
I didn't realize that there was a division of like of different in subgenres of punk rockers and indie rockers and hipsters and posers and scenesters. Hippies didn't hang out with punks and punks didn't hang out with heshers, because it wasn't like that. Because if we didn't hang out with each other, we would be alone.
Then I'll talk with Ernest Dickerson. It's a guy who's had a long, fascinating career in filmmaking. He's a director with a ton of movie and TV credits to his name. He also handled the cinematography for some of Spike Lee's best movies. He actually met Spike at NYU. They studied film there. They were part of a pretty small group of black students at this school. Even in a progressive place like New York, being black at NYU wasn't easy.
There were a couple of black students that had been there for a couple of years before we got there, and when they came up there, they were basically saying, don't embarrass us, okay? You know, this is a work school. You got to come here and work. This is not a party school.
Finally, I'm going to do an outshot about Car Talk, the best public radio show ever. And I know all those Calling All Pets fans out there are like, oh snap, shots fired. We'll see. It's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My first guest this week is Beth Ditto. She's a singer and a songwriter. She was born and raised in Searcy, Arkansas. She moved to Washington State out of high school, and she made a name for herself as the singer in The Gossip. The band first broke through in the early 2000s, coming up with dance punk groups like The Rapture, LCD Sound System, and Liars. But while those bands were arty, dark, and a little self-serious, The Gossip were fun. They were proudly queer. And seriously, Beth Ditto can sing.
Because we're standing in the way of control, we will live our lives, lives, lives. Ooh. Oh, hey.
The Gossip broke up last year, and in the wake of all of that, Beth Ditto has her first solo album out. It's called Fake Sugar. The album's a departure from The Gossip sound, more of a pop record. But Beth's voice has only grown in range and power. Like now, instead of sounding sort of like, let's say, Donna Summer, you can hear some Stevie Nicks and maybe even some Tina Turner. Here's a single from the new album. It's called Fire.
Get up, 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 up. If you want my love. Bless my soul, that's the way it is.
Beth Ditto, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here.
How old were you when you moved from your hometown to Olympia, Washington?
Oh, look at you. You know the real place. I was 18 years old. I graduated. I turned 18 February of 99. I graduated in May of 99, and I moved in June of 99.
Did you go to school, or did you go to not go to school?
I went to follow my friends. They moved up there because one of my friends went to school who we started gossip together. But she moved to go to Evergreen, and so I looked around, and all of my weirdo friends were gone, and so I just moved up there to be with them. No, I never went to school. Mm-mm. I barely graduated high school, let alone more of that, and also, like, left entirely up to my own devices. I would have just gotten a lot of debt and a whole lot of nothing.
You mean had you gone to school?
Yeah, yeah.
What was the scene like in your hometown?
Hilarious.
Where was it?
Hilarious. I grew up in Judsonia, which is just outside of Searcy, which is about... Searcy's when you were like, when you, it was Saturday morning and you'd be like, your mom would be like, we're going to town. You went to Searcy. That's where you got groceries and stuff. So that's where the Walmart was. So that's where I met Kathy and Nathan and Jerry and a few other kids too. But that's who I moved to Olympia with. You know, we had our own little scene there, and like there weren't that many of us. We were all really different. We all were into different things. I think they were much cooler than me. They were also older than me, but you know, Kathy was 3 years older than me, Nathan was two, Jerry was 1 year older, which is why I moved after. But I wasn't as cool as they were. So I was listening to old music and was into different things on my own, like even feminism and things like that. Like I hadn't really gotten into Riot Girl deeply yet when I'd met them at all. Like it was something I'd heard passed around, but it wasn't anything I knew a lot about. I was more like listening to like Mama Cass and Nina Simone and, you know, just Tori Amos was a big one for me. I listened to a lot of Melanie and, you know, that's pretty much where... That's where my music nerdiness came from, was old music. So I was a natural weirdo, and they were natural weirdos. And the ideas that we even, that the notion we even met each other is really incredible. I mean, we looked so ridiculous. Like, I remember my friend Jerry cutting off his pant legs and then wearing tube socks with the shorts that he'd made, but then, like, safety pinning the pant legs to his sleeves. So, like... And then wearing, taking apart computers and wearing the circuit board yeah. on his shirt because he was such a cyber techie kid, like pre-internet. The first time I saw the internet, it was at his house, actually, in the 90s. And it was the slowest, most ridiculous dot matrix pixelated thing I've ever seen. Like it took
Beth,
like
you're just
hours.
You're describing like a second grader building a robot. You're not describing a high schooler
yeah.
designing fashion.
No, that was what it was. And that's why it was so amazing. It was so innocent and like really untouched. I mean, because the beauty was is that we were second graders. If you had gone to those shows that we were playing for each other, like it was so different from anything else. And it was unpretentious. If everyone was just having fun, hippies were hanging out. Like I didn't realize that there was a division of like, of different in subgenres of punk rockers and indie rockers and hipsters and posers and scenesters. Hippies didn't hang out with punks and punks didn't hang out with heshers because it wasn't like that. Because if we didn't hang out with each other, we would be alone. So the beauty was like we didn't, and also MTV wasn't a thing unless you had a satellite dish because our cable company was too Christian to carry it. You couldn't get it. And so we were really cut off in this way that what we had, we envisioned what we thought a scene would be. So it was just the most, in some ways, like in retrospect, I remember Nathan and I talking about it, how it was so avant-garde. Like it was just so ridiculously made up and hilarious. Like, it was just really, it was really great and innocent. It was so fun.
What was it like for you when you had to adjust to living on the mean streets of Olympia, Washington?
I mean, everyone is nice, you know, I think in their own way. It's definitely not Southern nice, but that was me being very naive. You know, my wife still says, she's always like, you are so naive. And I'm like, I don't really feel naive, but I also just, I think it was amazing. Honestly, it was incredible. Like, I'm not throwing it under the bus. Speaking of buses, there were city buses, and I'd never seen that before. I'd never been on a city bus. I'd never lived in a town with a mall. When I was a kid, the mall was somewhere you went once a year, maybe, you know, and your school took you on a field trip. It was just like you know, if you were really lucky, your parents gave you $20 and you could go to the Spencer's and get a T-shirt with a Mr. Potato Head on it. Like,
I don't mean to interrupt, Beth, but you went on a school field trip to the mall?
Well, we would go to different places in Little Rock, you know, and then we would go to the mall for lunch and then we would eat at the food court and then we could shop for about an hour.
Got it. I thought that is a strange use of the academic calendar. But if you're going to the zoo and then you're stopping in for lunch, I get that.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, you think about it, it's like, sure, it's like maybe it's not like academic, but there's some kids, you know, where we're from that would never have gotten to go had it not been for that. And if you think about that in its own way, like culturally, that's really important. Like they would never have seen, except for maybe the hospital at that time, maybe one of the banks, and even been in a place with an elevator. And like that's or an escalator or anything. And that in its own way, that's pretty important, too. So it just depends on how you look at it. I was in remedial math in 8th and 9th grade. And I swear to you, they took the kids that were in special ed and remedial classes and they would take us every year, just us, to tour the prisons. That's not a joke. And so that you could see what your life would turn out if you didn't smarten up or straighten up or, like, get your life together.
So did you have a vision of what your life was going to be at all?
You know what's crazy is I tried, and this just dawned on me when you asked me that question. I tried as hard as I could to have a decision made for me because I didn't have one. Like, I'm so grateful for my high school boyfriend for not knocking me up, because there were times when I was like, you have to get me pregnant, because I didn't want to come out of the closet. I didn't want to make that life decision. I wanted it to be made for me. I wanted to have to live for somebody else. And what a nightmare sentence that would have been. And I feel like there are a lot of people around there that would have totally done that.
Did you, at the time when you were a teenager, did you know that you were a lesbian?
Yeah, definitely. And so did he, which is funny. I really had, you know, I put him through the wringer. I was always like, I think I'm gay. I need to break up with you. But we were together for 3 years. I mean, I sent him an email a long time ago that was like, you know, I just want to say thank you. You were the best boyfriend a high school lesbian could have had.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Beth Ditto. For years, she fronted the band Gossip. Her solo debut, Fake Sugar, is out now. What was it like for you when you got to Olympia? And not only were there teams of rock and rollers, but there were like specific lesbian teams as well.
Oh, man. I learned so much. There was so much about my own sexuality and gender that I didn't even know. I mean, I was 18 and like off the turnip truck. Like, I still believed in God. I mean, I was still under the thumb of the Bible Belt. I was still living in that, you know, fear. So like, just to meet other people who were queer and like they had, you know, and different queer identities and genders and like the fluidity of all of that, like it changed my life. It was so incredible. Like, it was like the best. It was like, the thing about Olympia, I lived there for 4 years and then I moved to Portland. The thing about Olympia that was so incredible is that some people went to go to school and they went to Evergreen and they went for their 4 years. Some people didn't finish or whatever. Some people are still there. But for me, it was 4 years of college of like complete life experience where I learned so much about, you know, it was like a queer, it was a queer women's study in itself. Like, I learned so many things. And like, it's another thing I'm really grateful for. It's the other thing. It's just like, you know, I knew about grunge and stuff like that. I knew about Seattle and I was obsessed with it, of course, but I really didn't know about Olympia. And like, if I'd have been a little teenager, I would have been like, what? That's crazy. I learned so much. I mean, you know, listen, you take that bus downtown, you go to the Capitol Theater, you go to Homo Agogo. There's kissing booths. I mean, there were like queer kissing booths where you could pay a dollar to kiss another girl. That was my first kiss. That's the first time I kissed a girl. I paid a dollar. So cheap. That is a bargain. That is a steal, my friend.
Good investment?
Yeah, great investment.
Was there a moment, Beth? I mean, I talked to Corin Tucker of Slater Kinney, and she described to me when she saw Kathleen Hanna perform for the first time, who was in Bikini Kill and La Tigre, that it was so thrilling to her to see that a woman could do that. And it was so just what she had never known that was exactly what she wanted to do and be, that it felt like, you know, it was a real Unchain the Beast moment. Did you ever have a moment when you were starting the gossip with your friend from back home, Nathan, who's known in the band as Brace Payne?
And also Kathy, to remember, too. Yeah. She was from back home, too.
So did you guys ever, like, was there a moment when you acknowledged, when you saw what you wanted and maybe even felt like you could do it?
I think Nathan probably saw it more than we did. And no. I remember, I mean, later you do when you realize, oh, you actually have a thing and people are actually coming to see you on tour, and like you're on tour, period. Like, I remember that moment. It was, you know, I remember being like, I want to do this for a living. If I can, I never thought about doing it for a living. I never thought about being a musician. I mean, watching Slater Kinney was, I have to say also that I am forever in their debt. They took us on tour and gave us everything. We weren't hip enough to like punk tours that we even knew that you needed to like, I can't even tell you what we didn't know. We were just scatterbrained, crazy. Like, we were just like, our friend was like, we'll drive you. We're like, okay. We didn't even think, hey, maybe you should hire her as a roadie. We just like saw her as a driver. We would just show up and be like, can we borrow your amp? Like, we never even thought, we didn't know what a sound check was. I didn't know what monitors were. Like, I didn't, they, I had no, and that went on for years. I didn't know, it was way after a Slater Kinney tour. But they really, like, if we needed anything, Carrie would let us sleep in the floor in her room, all of us. Like, in her, like, hotel rooms. Like, she didn't
and
have
And this
to
is when, I mean, by the time you were touring with them, they were legitimate rock stars. They
oh,
were,
yeah. This was All Hands on the Bad One tour. This is like, so, like, I had been listening to them at home. But here's the other thing is, like, I had no idea. The other thing is, like, I saw them as, they were rock stars to me, but nobody I knew who they were growing up. Because it wasn't that kind of scene. It wasn't that connected. So we were very, it was a very small group of people. But when I realized, I guess, just how big they were, I was like, whoa, baby, whoops. So it was kind of a blessing that I didn't know. It's just a whirlwind. But yeah, at this time the first time we ever played San Francisco was the Fillmore, and it was with them. I mean, there was a moment when I had decided with my girlfriend I was going to go back to Arkansas because I could go to beauty school for free with financial aid because I was still technically a resident there, blah, blah, blah. And my first girlfriend and I were going to go back and go to beauty school for really cheap and live with my sister and blah, blah, blah. And I had told this to Kathy, who was playing drums and gossip, and she had told this to Carrie. And we were at the Crystal Ballroom, and we were still opening for them. And Carrie asked the crowd in the middle of their set, she was like, who here thinks that Beth should go back to Arkansas and become a hairdresser? And everybody booed. And then, still to this moment, it chokes me up. And then after that, she was like, who here thinks, raise your hand if you think Beth should stay here and pursue her rock and roll career. And everybody cheered and raised their hand. And I remember Kathy looked at me and she hugged me really tight. And then Carrie looked at me and I was just like, and after that, I was just like, oh, this people believe in me, you know? I think that was a thing with Slater Kinney too. And all of them is like, kindness wasn't always a punk thing either. Even though it's like sisterly and feminist, there's a warmth that is really necessary for me that was missing. And Slater Kinney really showed us that warmth. So I'm always grateful to them. It actually kind of tears me up because to me that was the most empowering moment of sisterhood, one of them that I had experienced my entire career of Olympia career.
We've got more of my interview with Beth Ditto after a break. Still ahead, Beth talks about her new solo album and how recording it gave her a chance to look back on her childhood and her hometown in a different way. She says that up until now, nostalgia hasn't really been her thing. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. We'd like to say a quick thank you and share a message from one of our sponsors, Stoke Cold Brew Coffee. The folks at Stoke are obsessive about building bold and smooth taste, finding the right beans, finding the right grind, brewing at cool temperatures for at least 10 hours to keep out those incorrect flavor notes. Slow brewed, just like good ideas. Find it in the refrigerated juice section. Stoke Cold Brew Coffee. Look at you go.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here. If you love this podcast, you might also love the TED Radio Hour. It's a show about what it means to be a human. We grieve, we experience joy, sadness, love, and jealousy. We can be cruel and empathetic. We have the capacity to imagine the future and the past. And at a time when it seems we're so divided, the TED Radio Hour explores what makes us unique among all species. Find it on Apple Podcasts, the NPR One app, or however you get your podcasts.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to the singer Beth Ditto. For over 15 years, she sang in the rock band Gossip. Now she's just released Fake Sugar, her first ever solo album. When your friend Nathan, who had co-founded The Gossip with you,
mm-hmm.
moved back home to live on the farm that he grew up in, and you ultimately decided to break up the band sort of by mutual acclamation, did you feel confident that you could make music on your own without this guy who had been like your big brother forever?
No. I didn't feel... I think had I set out to make a solo record in the first place, like if I was like, baby, I'm going solo, it would have been different. But I think because I was already writing for the Gossip record anyway, and there were already songs that just weren't Gossip songs, and I was like, well, why would I throw these away? I think I knew that I had songs already. Now, had I made a decision to do it by myself without songs, I don't know what would have happened. But I have this thing, and, you know, I always say that I'm at the musician's mercy. Like, I'm at the guitar player's mercy. I'm only as good as the player that I'm with or the person that's making the music, because I can't read music. I can't play it. I can hum it. You know, I can say, maybe, can you try to play it like this, or give my ideas and try to communicate them, but I can't tell you what to do. I don't really know the language. So I'm only as good as the person that I'm with. And so that's frightening. But at that point, I'd already had things. You know, I'd already had music. And I think because I was writing for Gossip, it gave me... I always say that I think Gossip was over 2 years before it was over. I think when Nathan moved back, it was over. The last show I think that we played together was the night before my wedding. I think that was 4 years ago. So, not the night before my wedding, but the night before I left for the trip. And, so I think it was over a long time ago.
It must have, Beth, been scary to kind of lose him to the thing that had taken the two of you into the, you know, down the path of starting a band in the first place, that the two of you had left town together, so to speak.
And well, he taught me everything.
And then to have him go back, and I understand he was born again, and it's just he chose to go back to the life that the two of you had agreed to leave when you were teenagers.
Not only that, but that gave us fuel to do what we did. Like, our escape, I think, from Arkansas, and our absolute just like need for distance and something else, drove us to do everything that we did. And when you think about, like, that is now, you know, the potential that he could turn into that person. And I don't think he will. He's not a homophobic, you know, sexist, crazy person. And I like to call him the Billy Zoom of gossip. That's what I always called him before, you know, gossip. While we were still on tour and stuff, and he was finding God, I was like, you're just such a little evangelist. Like, because he is very charismatic. The thing about Nathan is that he's a damn genius. He's the funniest person I've ever met. The longest relationship I ever had. The longest job I ever had. The longest project I ever did was with him. I've never been anywhere in the world with more people, with anyone else, with, you know what I mean? Like, we saw everything together. Everything. I mean, like, you know, we went from squats to Four Seasons. And, like, that's so real. And the thing is that is sad. Going out and doing whatever by myself, like making music, playing shows, none of that is sad or difficult. None of it. And, you know, it's not, I don't feel like the breaking up was the hardest thing. You know, Kathy, when we decided, we kicked Kathy out of the band when Hannah came along. That was the hardest thing I ever had to do with gossip until Nathan left. And, you know, people are like, Beth, you left the gossip. And I was like, no, it just stopped. And it stopped a long time ago. It's like when you're in a marriage or in a romantic relationship, you really know, you know it's over, but no one's saying it. It was like that.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Beth Ditto. Her debut solo album, Fake Sugar, is out now. Your solo album, as it turned out, kind of feels like it's got a lot of home in it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I think I used my 20s and my late teens and gossip, and we used all of that, you know, coming out of the closet, all of that excitement, being surrounded by feminists and being surrounded by music and going to a show, whether it be a good show or a bad show. You know, bad bands happen to good people, good bands happen to bad people. It's just like, whatever it was, it's like you had all of that. Like, you know, Olympia to some people doesn't seem like a very big thing, but for me, it was a huge, I'd never lived in a town that big. I'd never been exposed to that much stuff. So, like, we had all this great stuff, and, like, we used, like, our childhood and our past, and we used them to, like, fuel and motivate our youth. And all of the paths that we took and all of the great things that happened to us and all the great people that we met. And I feel like now I'm using it to fuel nostalgia. And, like, I'm kind of seeing it through a soft focus lens, especially, like, I lost my dad in 2011. So, like, you start to realize that all of these bad memories that you had, like, if he was still living, you still see them as existing. And, you know, they're memories that are still connected to these feelings because this person is still living. They're still raw. They're still alive. But when my dad died, enough time had gone by that I started to look at things fondly. Even the weird little things where you're like, you know, my dad had really, really bad arthritis, and that's what killed him. But, like, he had rheumatoid arthritis so bad that his hands, he couldn't slap us in the head because he'd knock us in the head. Like, if we said something, like if I cussed on accident or something. I remember my sister was like, I dare you to do Yankee Doodle with all F's. Well, when you say stuck a feather in his hat with an F, guess what he did with that feather in his hat? So I said that in front of my dad, and he would try to, like, backhand you a little bit. But instead of backhanding you, like, his hand was so stiff, it didn't really work. So it was just a thud. It was just like, booch. So when his hand stopped he could stop using them even less, and they were more, he couldn't use them. But anyway, they were like, you want to say, like, what is it called? Floppy? I don't know. But when he would thump you instead. And so, so, like, when you would get in trouble, because he couldn't hold the belt to whoop you, and he couldn't backhand you. He's very gentle, my dad. but he, for real, but he could only thump you. And like, when you look at that in retrospect, it sounds, you're like, what are you talking about? Whoopings and five across the eyes. But for, you know, when I talk about that with my siblings now, we laugh so hard at how funny that is. Not that Dad had arthritis, but there's the shock of the thump, because you never saw it coming. Yeah, when you look back on that kind of stuff, it's like, you, when someone's alive, you take that memory for granted. And when they're gone, you see it as this really whimsical, funny little memory that you're going to, that those are, and those are the things, and that's all you're ever going to have of that person. There's not going to be any new memories. So my dad used to take me to honky tonks, you know, and we used to go to the VFW because grew up in a dry county. So it was like the only place that you could get booze, and you had to be a member, of course. And, but my brother was, who was 14, and my cousin played boogie woogie piano and like would play Jerry Lee Lewis and like country music and Little Richard. And my brother played drums for him, and my dad would do sound for them. And my dad would take us on his weekends to have us, and we would go honky tonking and two stepping. And dad, you know, take us, he would get all dressed up, which meant that he would put on his country western belt and a vest that had his name tag on it that just said Homer. But those memories were so, when I think about music, and after all these years of answering interviews about music and like what people were listening to and what I grew up with and country music and soul music and blues music and all of that stuff, gospel music, I didn't think about it until he was gone how instrumental that was in me being a singer. So this record really, I wanted to make maybe a record that Dad would like. I mean, he was always really proud and, like, really into so funny. His doctor, he was just really, you know, he didn't see anybody else. He saw his wife, and he'd see us every once in a while. He only saw me once a year, if that. And he was always really proud to brag to his doctors and the nurses that his daughter was a singer.
Beth, we're plumb out of time, but I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful to you for coming on Bullseye. I really enjoyed getting to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Beth Ditto, everybody. Make sure to give her new record a listen. It's called Fake Sugar. It's out now. She's also got a bunch of tour dates coming up. Just head over to the Bullseye page on MaximumFun.org for more information. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My next guest is the director, Ernest Dickerson. Dickerson started working straight out of film school. As a cinematographer, he worked a lot with his classmate, Spike Lee. He DP'd on Do the Right Thing, She's Gotta Have It, and Malcolm X, among other movies. He's also got a ton of TV credits to his name. He's directed The Walking Dead, Law and Order, and a few of the best episodes of The Wire. 25 years ago, Ernest directed and co-wrote his first ever feature-length movie. It's called Juice. Juice was a box office and critical success. It also helped kick off the acting careers of people like Omar Epps, Queen Latifah, Khalil Khan, and maybe most notably, Tupac Shakur. To celebrate its 25th anniversary, Juice is getting a long-awaited re-release on Blu-ray. Juice is sort of a modern film noir that presents itself at first as a coming-of-age story. It's about four teenagers growing up in Harlem, and at the beginning, their friends who ditch school together, maybe shoplift every now and then, get harassed by the cops, have little spats with a local gang. But as the movie progresses, Juice raises the stakes at every turn. Things get more and more complicated and nuanced as violence seeps into the situation. Let's take a listen to a scene from Juice. This is early on in the movie. It's kind of a turning point. The four main characters are hanging out in an apartment watching TV. Earlier on, they ran into a friend as he was about to rob a bar. Then, in this scene, they hear on the news that he got killed by cops while he was doing it. Bishop, played by Tupac, thinks it's a sign that he and his crew aren't getting the respect they deserve. And unless they go hard, they never will.
We run from the cops. We run from Rodimus. We run from security guards. We run from old man Quills in the bull store when he come with that bull gun. All we do is run. Feel like I'm on a goddamn track team. I'm serious. What's the matter, Ryan? Nothing to say? That's because you know I'm right. In your heart, you know I'm right.
Yo, big man, if you want respect, you gotta earn it.
You damn right. You gotta be ready to go down, stand up, and die for that like Blizzard did if you want some juice.
Ernest Dickerson, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So, did you always aspire to be a filmmaker?
It took me a while to figure it out. I was always interested in movies from way back, I mean, since elementary school. Movies were always a part of my house, movies and good jazz. You know, Saturdays and Sundays, a bunch of us would go to the movies, and we always loved adventure films and stuff like that, horror films, you know, scary movies. Movies like The Tingler, you know, The Great Escape, really good adventure films. So always loved movies. Started thinking seriously about it later on, but I was always interested in the craft. Started out being interested in visual effects, because I was a big Ray Harryhausen fan. And, you know, seeing a lot of fantasy films and horror films and science fiction films, I was always interested in the visual effects.
You're saying you were a nerd.
Yeah, definitely. Back in the 60s when it wasn't so fashionable to be one.
So what did being interested in the effects mean? I mean, were you at home trying to make your own squibs?
I did do some effects, you know, with some firecrackers. I remember my favorite show at that time was The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And they always had this thing where they would take out a lock with something they put in the lock and then sparks would just come out. So I used to do that by taking firecrackers and tearing them in half and putting them in locks or stuff, you know, and seeing that. We would play with that. I became a little bit of a pyromaniac in the bathtub. I would take lighter fluid and I would just like squirt patterns in there and just light it and see it all just light up.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with the director and cinematographer, Ernest Dickerson. You went to film school. You got a master's degree in film.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there was a point in your life where you had to give yourself permission, or maybe even to ask your parents for permission, depending on where you were at with your parents, to not do the job. not pursue a practical career, but rather pursue a profoundly impractical career.
Well, the thing is, after I graduated, I got my degree in architecture. I had a part-time job at Howard Medical School and the hospital doing medical photography.
What is medical photography?
Surgery. I was in surgery sometimes 2 to 3 times a week.
So were you just like taking pictures of people's boils? What you've described to me in a very flat tone sounds like the grossest thing ever to me.
At first it was, you know. I mean, you know, they gave me a chance to kind of get used to things. They wouldn't let me take a photograph for a couple of months, you know, but they let me develop the film.
You know, they say there's nothing more magical than that moment when you pull that piece of photographic paper out of the chemicals,
yeah,
and you see that boil reveal itself.
I went to my girlfriend after the first couple of times I did it, because I'm shooting over the surgeon's shoulder and he's taking this person's leg off and they're wrapping it in a plastic bag and putting it in the corner so it can go to pathology. And I'm still shooting them cleaning up the mess and, you know, putting the flap of skin over the bone, and you know, but my eye keeps going to like that leg that's sitting over in the corner. So I went over to my girlfriend's house that night. And I said, "Oh God, I gotta smoke a joint."
Did you feel like you had to have or had a special seriousness because you were black?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, because I mean, that was some of the first stuff that Spike and I talked about, because we met first day.
Spike, you know? Lee.
Yes. There weren't too many African-Americans or Africans. There weren't too many black folks in the class there. They definitely didn't take us seriously. I mean, even some black students, there were a couple of black students that had been there for a couple of years before we got there. And when they came up, they were basically, don't embarrass us, okay? You know, this, you know, you, you, this is a work school. You got to come here and work. You don't, this is not a party school. And, you know, Spike and I looked at each other, this is bull. You know, we always worked our asses off.
That's why we're in graduate school.
Exactly.
Right now.
You know?
We've got more of my conversation with Ernest Dickerson in a minute. After a break, we'll talk about Juice, which is a huge hit movie that, because he wanted his creative control, he made for practically nothing. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and this message comes from 2020, where creatives get inspiring, authentic stock photos. Unlike traditional staged stock photos, 2020 has millions of real-world images your audience will actually engage with, all under a simple royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering Bullseye listeners a 7-day free trial of 5 photos. Monthly subscription begins after 7 days. To start your trial, go to TWENTY20.com/Bullseye. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. We'll get back to my conversation with Ernest Dickerson. But before we do that, Pop Rocket time. Pop Rocket, if you don't know, our sister show here at MaximumFun.org, our chattier sister show. When you listen to Pop Rocket every week, a brilliant, hilarious panel looks at why we love what we love in pop culture. A bunch of heavy hitters, the novelist and entertainment writer Margaret Wappler, pop culture scholar Karen Tongson from the University of Southern California, and the great social media strategist Winter Mitchell. It's hosted by our friend Guy Branum. He's a comedian. He hosts talk show The Game Show on True TV, one of the funniest shows on TV. Hey, Guy, buddy, what's popping on Pop Rocket this week?
Hey, Jesse. In honor of Independence Day, we will be celebrating by honoring the works of fiercely independent artists like Beyonce, Tina Turner, and maybe even Salman Rushdie, people who declared their independence through art.
Yeah, that's what's up. I like Tina Turner talk. Pop Rocket. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking with Ernest Dickerson. Ernest is a cinematographer and a director. He's worked on nearly 100 movies and TV shows, including Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, and The Wire, plus, you know, Crush Groove. His directorial debut, Juice, is celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. You DP'd the first few films that your film school classmate Spike Lee made, including some of his greatest films. I want to play a scene from one of those. I'm going to play a scene from Do the Right Thing. It's one of my favorite movies.
Okay.
If folks haven't seen it, it's just sort of a slice of life, day in the life of this block in this neighborhood in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn. In this scene that we're about to hear, a guy called Buggin' Out is at the pizzeria having some pizza. The pizzeria is Italian-owned. Buggin' Out is black. They have a wall of fame in the pizzeria. And there's no black folks in the wall of fame.
Hey, Sal, how come we got no brothers on the wall here?
You want brothers on the wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
You looking for trouble?
Are you a troublemaker? Is that what you are?
You making trouble?
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker. I'm making trouble.
Yeah.
It's one of the most beautiful movies that I've ever seen.
Oh, thank you.
You know, it kind of radiates the color of 1989. Like, the aesthetics of the clothes are so central to it. Hmm. Those kind of bold color block clothes that people were rocking in 1989 are such an essential part of this, kind of this vision of this block. What did you talk to Spike Lee about in terms of what this movie was going to look like?
Well, that process started months earlier. He and I were on a plane flying from New York to L.A. to look at the answer print for School Days. And he started writing. He had been writing something that at that time was called Heat Wave. And he was telling me, yo, man, I'm writing this film. It's set on the hottest day of the summer. Figure out how we can get the audience to feel the heat of the summer. And I started thinking first about color, because color photography to me had always been a big thing, especially, you know, color films where the color was used in ways to help tell the story. It was an article in Playboy that I read. It was actually an interview with John Huston in Playboy where he talked about the painterly use of the visuals in his films, how he felt that every film should have its own palette, its own look, its own approach to color. And so I decided that the best way to do this was to limit the color scale to mostly yellows, reds, you know, earth tones, really minimize or stay away from blues and greens, which have a calming effect. Psychological use of color was something I started, like, really studying. Noticing that, you know, on submarines, the color scheme inside submarines are usually blues and greens and colors that actually have a tendency to relax you and calm you down.
Same with hospitals and psych wards, famously,
As opposed to reds and yellows, you know, red actually causes the heart rate to increase. You know, I just felt the best way to do that was to limit the color scale to those warmer colors. And the great thing that Spike did, they gave me 4 weeks of paid pre-production. So I had a chance to come in and lay down some ground rules. That the problem was that this was all going to be taking place on one day. We were going to be shooting for 8 weeks. How am I going to make 8 weeks look like one day where we're outside a lot and almost every shot we're seeing the entire block or we're seeing a large part of the block? And so I just lay down the ground rule. Whatever street we select for this, it has to run north and south. And my rationale was that as the sun rises in the east and sets in the west, a street that runs north and south, one side of the street is always going to be shaded. It's easy for me to make a cloudy day look like the shaded side of the street, which saved my butt because we had almost nothing but rain for the first 2 weeks of shooting.
The movie culminates in, spoiler alert for this movie that came out in 1989 that you should have seen by now and which you will not lose out on just by knowing how it ends. It culminates in a riot. Mm. And it is the climax of the film. Mm. It's not about dialogue. How did you and Spike Lee design what that would look like?
Honestly, Spike was pulling it all together, pulling the film together. And his hands were full, and he asked me to design the sequence. So I worked with a storyboard artist. That was Spike trusting me, you know, because he didn't have time and he needed somebody to concentrate on that. So that was the first of two instances where he let me design key scenes in a film.
Let's take a listen to that scene from Do the Right Thing. When you got the chance to direct your first film, was it something that came to you or something that you've been working on for years and years?
It was actually something that me and a friend of mine co-wrote not long after I got out of NYU, before my career as a cinematographer took off. And after, I think, my first films, I tried to take it out. We tried to take it around and see if anybody could be interested in the script. It was called Juice at that time. It was basically the story that eventually got made. Some of the characters changed. Queen Latifah's character in the script was originally Afrika Bambaataa. So we just got rejected every place we got, every place we went. So it just sat on the shelf. We said, I'll forget about it. My career as a DP was taken off. Gerard's career as a playwright was working and taken off. He was at Public Theater with Joe Papp. And so, just, you know, it just sat on the script. I mean, the script sat on the shelf for years.
And then what happened. Boys in the Hood became an international phenomenon, and all of a sudden somebody was willing to make a movie like that?
No, we didn't know anything about it. What happened was that Gerard was going to get a new agent. She wanted to see some work, and, you know, he gave her a copy of Juice. And she read it, and she says, what are you doing with this? What's happening with this? And he said, nothing. It's just been sitting there for years. She says, well, you should make this. So she took it, and she took it around, and automatically there were about four or five production companies that wanted to buy it. And then we started getting notes. We started getting notes from the company saying that it was too dark. They thought it should be more of a comedic coming-of-age story between these four guys, you know, to lighten up the tone, more one-liners. And Gerard and I are reading this, and we're saying, nah, man, come on. This is bull****, you know.
It's a pretty dark movie.
Yeah, but I mean, but it's
structurally, at the very least, there's some warm-hearted, coolie high stuff for the first half an hour or so. But, you know, it's a noir film.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing it as a warm coming of age story would be a very different film.
Yeah. I mean, it was written as a film noir that could actually happen in Harlem, was happening in Harlem at that time, where the main characters were 16, 17-year-old guys. You know, that was what we made it as, and that's what we wrote it as. And so we just said, nah. This is turning into something we don't want our names on. And, you know, there were movies that we were looking at that said, you know, that was a good idea, but I bet you it just got developed into a piece of shit. And so we basically took the script back. We said, thank you, but no, we don't want to do that to this. And life goes on. And then one day I get a phone call from a young guy named David Heyman, who was looking for the first film to produce, you know, him and some friends. And so he called me. He says, look, I read your script, and I'm interested in talking to you. I want to see what kind of movie you want to make. So I met him, had brunch with him, talked for a couple of hours, told him this was a movie. It's a film noir. It's got to be real. It's not a studio film. It's got to be shot on the streets of Harlem. I said, there's no young actors that we know of that can play these roles. So we got to get unknowns, you know, really find new unknowns to play these roles. Talked for a couple of hours, and he said, I like what you have to say about it. Do you want me to get funding for it? And I said, yeah.
It's the 25th anniversary of Ernest Dickerson's film Juice. It's just been re-released in a deluxe edition on Blu-ray. Let's take a listen to a scene from the movie, which Ernest directed and co-wrote. So the four protagonists, this little gang, lowercase g,
The crew,
are robbing a convenience store. And while they rob a convenience store, the character played by Tupac Bishop shoots the owner of the convenience store. And he didn't really need to. You know, this was the worst crime they'd ever done as a team.
Yeah.
And everyone else is kind of flipping out. They've just run away, and we hear them just as they run out.
Yo, man, what the f***? Man, what we gonna do now?
Right here, man. We got to get rid of the gun.
Yeah, you're right, man.
Yo, Bishop, man, give me the piece.
No.
No? What the hell you mean no? Give me the gun.
I mean, I'm holding on to this till I say so.
I'm not playing.
Oh, really?
Hey, stop this, man!
Chill, man.
You stop,
man!
Chill!
I think it's telling that you describe the movie as a noir.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a lot of movies like this are shot and presented relatively naturalistically. Even if the action is grand, the presentation is almost casual. And I think the fact that this is like on the street in Harlem, you're shooting these buildings mm-hmm. in these big angles, everything feels like
Brick City.
Yeah, I mean, everything feels like a geometry problem. You know what I mean? Everything feels bound by mm-hmm. these hard lines. And the action is, I mean, the characters watch White Heat in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the action is kind of bound by these hard geometric lines and these really intense emotions. that feel like very different from like what you would see in a similar movie set in L.A.
Well, I mean, you know, in New York, you know, we were living in New York. It was a brick city. I grew up in housing projects in Newark. You know, that's a brick city. Growing up in vertical environments, living in apartments, you know, walking through hallways, walking through alleyways. To me, there was, yeah, I was definitely going for like a certain kind of expressionism, you know. Yeah, no doubt about it. The old German expressionist films, a lot of times which were dealing with crimes in the city, were a big influence on us. And when we saw something like Boys in the Hood, we were like, well, what are they so upset for? They got houses with lawns, you know, they got palm trees in their yards, you know. They got real homes. They don't have, they're not living in little apartments. We just couldn't, you know, relate to that environment because it was 180 degrees from where we had grown up, where we are coming up, and where we set our story. So, yeah, that is living in the city, life in the big city.
And looking at the film now, 25 years later, you realize what a liminal place New York was in between the New York of the 1970s and 80s, that kind of bleakness and that turn to the sanitized Giuliani New York aesthetics. Like it was still in New York. On the one hand, it feels almost recognizably modern. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels almost contemporary, but it's also still in New York where you're walking past a burned out car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's true. And some places up there are still like that in New York. I was shooting in New York recently, and you know, there's some areas that haven't been gentrified that still have that feel. But that was an environment that I knew, that I spent most of my formative years in. You know, the whole jumping from rooftop to rooftop was something I used to do as a kid. Dumb, stupid stuff.
You literally jump from rooftop to rooftop?
Yeah.
There's a scene where they're running from the cops and they kind of act like they're going to turn themselves in, and then they jump across a chasm. About made me sick in my stomach just looking at it.
Yeah, we used to do that. And there was one time when a friend of mine didn't make it and fell and got impaled on a fence. Some criticism I got for the film was that, well, we don't see the influence of the parents in these kids' lives. But it was a definite decision to keep the parents really minimal, because it was about the kids' lives after they leave the house. You know, whenever I left the house, my mother never knew the stuff I was getting into. And, you know, she would have been shocked at some of it. She never knew that I jumped from rooftop to rooftop. But, you know, and even when the film came out, I didn't tell her I got it from real life, you know. And my mom is in the film, too.
Hey, she's a gun dealer in the movie,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she plays sweets, yeah.
Well, I don't even have time to get into your amazing TV work, including directing some of the most important episodes of The Wire and directing, being one of the most prolific directors on the most successful television show on TV, The Walking Dead. But I am so grateful that you took the time to come here and talk to me.
Thank you. I mean, if you ever want to do it again and do continuation, I'm up for it. I'm cool.
Solid. Ernest Dickerson, thank you so much for coming and being on Bullseye.
Thank you for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Every week on Bullseye, we like to wrap things up with a pop culture recommendation from me, your host. It's The Outshot. I mean, it's about that laugh, right?
I think that's about 25.
That dumb, ridiculous, charming, amazing laughter. That's Car Talk, right? Two brothers acting dumb and laughing. It's magic. For 40 years, we could turn on the radio on a weekend morning and hear that laugh. Or, I guess, those laughs. But honestly, I could never tell which one was Tom and which one was Ray. Going to the grocery store or a Little League game or a garage sale, Saturdays at 10, Sundays at 9, whenever they came on where you live, it was always there. Whenever NPR started to feel pretentious or smug or humorless or whatever they say about NPR, there were Tom and Ray Malyazzi telling their dad jokes and laughing like fools.
A couple had been debating the purchase of a new vehicle for weeks. He wanted a new truck. She wanted a fast little sports car so she could zip through traffic around town. "Look," she said, "I want something that goes from 0 to 200 in 4 seconds or less. And my birthday's coming up. You could surprise me." For her birthday, he bought her a brand new bathroom scale. And then it says, "Services will be at the Downing Funeral Home on Monday, the 18th. Go 0 to 200 in 4 seconds.
Of course, I'm a radio producer, right? I can tell you why it works. Expertise is essential in talk radio. There's a reason that Mike Lupica never admits not knowing something about sports. There's a reason Lynn Rosetto Casper can make a recipe out of anything that's in your fridge. There's a reason Dr. Laura isn't just Laura. The Malyazzis, Click and Clack, the Tappet brothers, they were real experts. These two yahoos laughing uproariously at their own dumb jokes had genuine genius. They went to MIT. They actually owned a garage. They actually helped people with their cars on the air. A clown once told me, and I know that that is a weird setup, but it's real. A clown once told me that to be funny, you have to demonstrate mastery. On Car Talk, it's not a funny show if they're getting the car stuff wrong, but they get it right, and it's perfect.
All right, give it to us again now. As you're shifting from what to what happens where?
Right before I shift into, like, second, there'll be this humming noise that sounds like it's coming from my glove compartment.
Yeah, and once you've shifted into second?
Then it goes away.
Goes away.
What you have, Sandy, is a sympathetic vibration someplace, and you can
isn't that nice?
It is. It's kind of sweet, actually.
It is. Yeah,
you can reproduce this without even moving the truck. Sit there with the thing in neutral, mm-hmm. and step on the gas and try to figure out at what engine speed you hear the noise.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and bring it up to that engine speed and try to hold it there,
uh-huh.
and I bet you're going to get the same vibration. And I'm going to guess that it's coming not from the glove compartment, although it might be, but it might be coming from part of the exhaust system, maybe a heat shield on the exhaust.
Mm-hmm.
And if it isn't that, I think it's probably the choke pull-off.
And while Tom and Ray were uncommon geniuses of broadcasting, and I think also just in general, they also had a brilliant producer. Doug Berman started with them in Cambridge when they were a local show, and he buffed Car Talk to a fine sheen. Everything was tucked in at the corners, edited tautly, managed for maximum impact. And like a great stand-up act, the show never seemed anything less than completely spontaneous. I think that most of the folks who called in for car advice were shocked that they weren't actually listening live.
Hello, you're on Car Talk.
This is Maximilian.
Oh, of course.
Maximilian.
Max.
We'll call you Max for short.
Where are you from, Max?
Max, I'm from Valencia, California.
Yes.
And I'm listening to your program. I enjoy it so much. And I feel you two brothers are real mensch. not only this, you know, your audience are so funny. And I have a problem. And I thought maybe I'll give you a call and you might solve the problem, man.
What did you say about the stench? I didn't get all that.
Now, look, I'm a professional humorist. Like half my best friends are professional comedians. I should be immune to guys reading email forwards on the radio. But Car Talk isn't about great jokes. It's about two warm, open hearts, just kindness and generosity pouring out of your speakers. Some genuine expertise about cars and the incredible power of laughing at your own jokes. This fall, Car Talk is leaving us, and I'll miss it. That's my outshot.
Well, it's happened again. You've wasted another perfectly good hour listening to Car Talk.
That's all for this week's Bullseye.
Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Today in the park, we had a flyover from some fighter jets, and we briefly thought that we were under attack by, I don't know, I guess maybe the Russians? Hard to say exactly who it would be, but it was terrifying. Turns out they were just practicing for doing something for Independence Day at Dodger Stadium. So, shout out to fighter jets. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Thanks to the fine folks at Digital One in Portland for helping out with our Beth Ditto interview. And thanks to Maximum Fun's own Daniel Baruela for engineering that. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Christian Duenas. Production fellows at MaximumFun.org are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer at MaxFun is Laura Swisher. All our interstitial music is provided to us by the one and only DJW, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our theme, recorded by the Go Team, provided to us by them and by their label, Memphis Industries. Our thanks go to them. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free. Just go to MaximumFun.org. And while you're at it, check out the Bullseye page on Facebook. Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. We're sharing interviews. We're giving you sneak previews about upcoming Bullseye guests. Today, I posted an article about things that are on sale both on the Gwyneth Paltrow website, Goop, and on the Alex Jones website, InfoWars, including some kind of silver spray that you spray into the air. Don't know what it means. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.